The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Max Weinberg. Max has been the drummer for Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band for over 40 years. He's also known to millions of fans for his 17-year stint as the band leader and comedic foil to talk show host Conan O'Brien. Throughout his 50-year career, Max has played with some of the biggest and most diverse names in music, including James Brown, Paul McCartney, Bob Dylan, B.B. King, and Tony Bennett. He has also had the distinction of being the drummer on the two biggest-selling rock albums in history, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and Meat Loaf's Bat Out of Hell. On August 15th, Max will bring his Max Weinberg Jukebox Show to the City Winery in Chicago. Max Weinberg, welcome to the show.
Well, Kelly, thanks a lot. It's great to be with you.
In doing some research to prepare for the conversation, I was a little surprised to learn that when you first auditioned for Bruce Springsteen in 1974, you were actually playing drums in the pit band on Broadway for the production of Godspell.
No, that's exactly right. I was playing drums in the pit band, aptly named because you're in the pit, actually.
Right.
And I did that steady, actually, for about a year right before I met Bruce in the E Street Band, and as a substitute for a couple of years before that, while I was going to college and I was living in the suburbs of New Jersey, and this very popular show back in the early 70s had a hit record with Day by Day.
Uh-huh.
So it was fun to play the hit record, and but, you know, rock and roll was always number one in my heart and my soul, and it just kind of worked out, you know. But I thought at the time, you know, I was 23 years old. I thought at the time that I would maybe, you know, go into kind of studio work or
right.
Broadway, which was also, you know, something steady. And lo and behold, in the summer of 74, I see the ad in the Village of Voice put there by Bruce and the band looking for a drummer. And myself and I think about 60-something other guys went down to drum.
Wow.
With them. Everybody got a half hour, no matter how good or bad you were. And it was a Monday night. The show, Godspell, was dark.
Right.
That night. And I can remember, I only had one drum set. It was at the show. So I went to the theater, and I got a bass drum and a snare drum and the hi-hat, the cymbals that go up and down. And I wasn't trying to make any kind of statement, but when I walked in with, you know, two drums and a pair of cymbals, it was sort of like a minimalist statement, like, whoa, this guy must think he's pretty good. He doesn't even need a whole drum set. But it was just I didn't want to carry the whole drum set down. And, you know, my basic style was pretty simple, you know, bass drum, snare drum, hi-hat, and a couple of fills. And that's what I've been doing for the last, you know, 45 years.
So Godspell not only propelled you into that gig, the Toronto production of Godspell featured Martin Short, Gilda Radner, all the sort of early Second City people who started in Toronto, and then a bunch of the SCTV guys,
yeah,
too. Yeah, so that show.
No, that's right.
Something about it.
That's right. And Paul Schaefer.
Oh, yeah. Paul was part of that, too.
Canada to Paul and I actually crossed over for a bit while we were both doing Godspell, but a lot of people came out of that show. A guy who's a very famous TV director now, Don Scardino.
Oh, sure.
The guy who played the engineer in Titanic, the designer of the Titanic, whose name I can't recall the second, he was in our production. But I can remember that when I, you know, after I got the job with Bruce and the E Street Band, coming in and giving my kind of 2 weeks notice, and one of the guys in the show, one of the actors said, "You are making the biggest mistake of your life, leaving a Broadway show. And, but, you know, I knew as soon as I played with Bruce and the E Street Band that I felt home.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because one of the things that we talk about frequently on this podcast is the power of the ensemble. So in improvisation or theatrical improvisation, there's this idea that, quote, all of us are better than one of us. And when you think about great sports teams, you know, like the Chicago Bulls teams from the 90s that I grew up with, they really achieve this kind of team flow. And you're part of an incredible ensemble. And one time I saw a quote that you said, which was, quote, chemistry is everything. What is it about that sort of powerful ensemble?
Well, the great bands in history, whether it's Count Basie or Duke Ellington or Buddy Rich Band, the bands that I admired in other than rock bands, chemistry is very important, particularly in rock bands, because rock bands is, you know, there's no charts, there's no sheet music, you're making it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't always have to be, you know, esprit de corps chemistry.
Right.
Sometimes it can be, you know, there's tension involved in this. If you look at the great bands throughout history, there was always tension.
Yeah.
You know, rock and roll is, and music in general, is the amalgamation of tension and relief. And in the E Street Band, the chemistry was really pretty incredible. It was incredible also before Roy and I joined. I mean, David Sanchez and Boom Carter are still fantastic musicians, and you know, it wasn't their cup of tea. So the chemistry was there, but their desire to move on to playing more fusion-esque kind of jazz overrode their desire to be in a rock band, where with Roy and I coming in 1974, you know, as a drummer, you have to be able to play a little bit of everything, but my heart and soul was rock and roll, and I understood that. And one of the biggest parts of chemistry is having a common musical vocabulary that composes your roots. So whether you may be different, you know, you obviously are different people, and actually in the E Street Band, you couldn't find more different people. And our commonality, other than the fact that we get along great, and we've been together for, as you say, some 40 years, 43 years, actually, in my case.
Wow.
Is that commonality of the music we grew up with and loved and played and learned from, and our appreciation of the detail of that music. And so that's a big part of the chemistry, you know, and also the desire, you know. In our case, look, we're very lucky to have in Bruce Springsteen one of the great performers, songwriters, singers, guitar players in rock history, you know, leading the band, and it's his band. And you very rarely, as a professional musician, I can tell you, you very rarely bump up against somebody like that.
Yeah.
And that is a one in a million. I don't even think the odds are one in a million. They're probably more than that, where, you know, you all sort of come together.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about him as a leader, and leadership in an ensemble is different because it requires that leader be able to give up power to the band. And this is the thing that, I mean, I'm such a big fan of the group, but the level of focus and listening and trading off and back and forth and letting everyone sort of have their star moment, and then not, it feels like in that moment on that stage, you all work as one, and you're very much able to surrender ego. And it might not be that way off the stage. I found that at Second City, that the best ensembles sometimes can be kind of a nightmare off the stage, but on stage, no problem. They're all sort of working as a unit.
Yeah, we're like that off stage, too.
Yeah.
And as Bruce has described many times, most recently in his best-selling book, Born to Run, it is a benevolent dictatorship, you know, they're his songs. They're everybody. You know, when we record, we threw our 2 cents in, and you know, there wasn't a lot of charts. There was not a lot of do this or do that. It was kind of everybody was left to their own devices, and it all fell together very organically on the, you know, the bulk of what we recorded, you know, say in the '70s and the '80s, and you know, leadership. I've got my own band. The leadership, yeah. Everybody approaches it differently, you know, and there is a thing of, you know, when we were younger, we were kids. In fact, our children are now older than we were when we met, Bruce and I.
Wow.
And, you know, you're a child, basically. So you're growing up together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so fortunate to have, you know, lived and played together this long, you know, save for the tragic and untimely deaths of Clarence Clemons and Dan Federici.
Right.
It's a privilege to be able to be, I'm 66, to be able to still play this music, dig into it as much as you can, still have the physicality and the credibility to play music in general, but Bruce's music specifically. It's a real, you know, it's a real honor, because I've played in a lot of bands all through my life, where whether they're cover bands or your original band, really the songs weren't that good, mm-hmm. you know, before I got in the E Street Band.
Right.
And so when you bump against somebody who's a real original, you realize it pretty quick. You know, mm-hmm. I did within the first 30 seconds of playing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it was not only the way he played, it was the way, at my first audition, it was Clarence, Gary Tallon, our bass player, and Dan Federici, our organist. It was the three of them. It was not just the way Bruce transmitted his thing, it was mm-hmm. the way they related to him. I'd never seen that kind of focus from a group of musicians, you know, playing, non-professional musicians playing, you know, together.
Right, right. I am curious, too, because you mentioned you've been at this for so long, and there's a lot of research out there that suggests that experts need to find ways to make themselves uncomfortable if they want to continue making discoveries. This kind of goes across fields, but I was reading some research recently. And I wonder if that's proven true for you, because I feel like, especially the Conan move, like you went into a whole uncomfortable, like, new area that sort of allowed you to keep yourself sort of fresh and interested, that you could then go back to the E Street Band as well.
Yeah, I guess that's true, you know, and fear is a great motivator.
Sure is.
And whether it's fear of failure, or fear of living up to your potential, or in my case, at that time, when I met Conan O'Brien, I'd been out of drumming, actually, for 3 or 4 years, where I didn't see my future as a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a two-year-old, and you know, wow, well, my daughter was, when I met Conan, my daughter was 5 and a half, my son was 2 and a half. And, you know, so this wasn't about me expressing my artistic vision. This was about me getting a really good job, if I could get it.
Right.
And doing a good job, if mm-hmm. I could get it.
Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, kind of a gift.
I'd never actually been on TV, except for one appearance on the short-lived Dennis Miller show. I sat in there one night. So I'd never done that kind of thing before. And it's good. It definitely is good to get out of your comfort zone, because you find out what you're made of. And I've talked about it before. The breakup of the E Street Band in 1989 was simultaneously the worst and the best thing that ever happened to me.
Sure.
And professionally, certainly at the time, the worst. It was very, very difficult to deal with. It was a huge, huge shock, but not a surprise. You know, mm-hmm. you kind of felt like we were moving. For years before that, we were kind of moving towards that dissolution. But, you know, like being sort of, you know, kicked out of the nest and out from underneath the protection of the Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band umbrella. Hmm. And, you know, adversity doesn't build character, as they say. It reveals character. And I had resources in myself that I didn't even know I had at the time. And whether it was protecting my family and doing the right thing by them, which was by far the most important thing for me, whether it involved drumming or not. And that was the and you want to talk about being out of your comfort zone. I was way out of my comfort zone.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I found out at that time that I wasn't in the music business.
Hmm.
I had been in a big band. I wasn't in the music business.
Hmm.
And it was, you know, I was, I don't know, 38 or 39 years old. And it was quite a shock. And the next 3 years were difficult and tremendous period of growth in the early 90s, which culminated with, you know, lo and behold, meeting Conan O'Brien, walked down the street when nobody knew Conan O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just been given the show, and nobody would have been better for that show than Conan, and did that for the next 17 years of my life, you know, and had to learn a whole new jargon with being on TV, and it, and when they started writing comedy bits for me, which by far is the hardest thing to do, to write good comedy. I'm not a comedy writer, but I tried to give the writers on that show everything they wanted, no matter what it was, no matter how outrageous it was. You know, I knew how hard they worked. You know, they worked early in the morning to very late at night, five nights a week on those shows,
mm-hmm.
particularly that show, you know, in the early days of Late Night Conan O'Brien. And it brought out a comedic side in me that, you know, I didn't even know I had. And I certainly never had a platform for it. Before I joined the TV show,
I was
very, very fortunate.
I was talking to my friend Brian Stack, who was a writer on Conan for many years, came out of Second City, and he told me that he was always impressed by your absolute willingness to let yourself be mercilessly made fun of for the greater good of the comedy, which is not something that everyone is willing to do.
Well, that was the job, you know.
And yeah.
Saw how, and Brian, you know, Brian, who's one of the great, great writers and actors
mm-hmm.
in comedy, in my view.
Oh, yeah.
Some of my favorite things that I've ever seen done were done by Brian Stack and a bunch of the guys, you know, who were there consistently through those years. It was all about commitment, you know, and I wasn't supposed to be funny. And I wasn't an actor. I wasn't a comedian. I was a rock drummer in a band in the back, doing what I did. And, you know, I really learned a lot, and they were both patient and generous in developing this sort of off the wall, you know, somewhat perverted character for me, that obviously wasn't me, but it played against my real type. And they, the writers, were perceptive enough, obviously, to pick up on that. And I was known as the guy who would do anything. And it's absolutely true. I would do anything for a laugh.
Hmm.
I would commit to anything. The only thing I couldn't do, that I didn't feel morally right in doing, was there was a moment when Conan hosted Saturday Night Live and they needed the end of a joke during the monologue. And what they came up with, Conan giving a tour of the whole studios there at NBC from the 8th floor to the 6th floor of our studio was. And at the end of the tour, after he had collected all these people along the way, he burst in, and there I am on his desk with a young lady.
No.
And I said, well, the bit is funny, but you know, they have a young model they wanted me to do.
Right.
It was really funny. I'm happy to do it. In fact, I was away on vacation, but I came back and I said, as long as my wife Becky can do it, I'll do it.
Right.
And she did, and she looked, you know, she was great. It was really funny. Had a big, big laugh, and mm-hmm. it was the final beat of the monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, back in the days when I was doing that stuff, for most of that time anyway, who had heard of, you know, YouTube or
right.
stuff? There was no YouTube.
Nope.
So this stuff had a shelf life of one night.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all over the place. And it's I find that, you know, sometimes I'll be surfing around and I'll come across something I did. And, you know, cracks me up.
Yeah, yeah,
and everybody, they were, I have to give all the credit to the writers. I mean, they were just, you know, relentless in writing, not just me, but for everybody, every character on the show, whether it was Brian McCann, Brian Stack, Michael Gordon, all the wonderful people who passed through there, you know. Really, it was an incredible experience. For the last 10 years of it, I got to do both playing with Bruce and the E Street Band and Conan.
Right, that's unbelievable.
Well, no one's ever done it in TV before.
No.
When the idea first came out, I called my friend Doc Severinsen, who to me still is the greatest leader of the Tonight Show ever.
Yep.
There's nobody even close. And the greatest moment for me was seeing my name in our brief tenure there in the same sentence as Doc Severinsen. But I called him and said, "Gee, Doc, what do you think about this? He knew I played with Bruce, and Bruce wanted me to go back on tour for a little while. He goes, "Well, what kind of time are we talking about?" Because I said, you used to take weekends off and
right,
you used to take time off later on. I said, "I don't know, 6 months?" He goes, "6 months? Are you out of your mind? You'll never get that job back."
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a leap of faith on everybody's part, and it worked out. So I did both jobs for 10 years. And one kind of helped the other, actually. They were very symbiotic in a certain sense. There's a great picture floating around somewhere that was taken when we debuted the Rising album on Saturday Night Live. During the rehearsal, Conan came up. There's a great picture that their staff photographer took of me standing in the middle of Conan and Bruce, each of them pulling an arm.
Huh.
It's never surfaced. I'm sure they have it there, but I've never actually seen it online anywhere.
You bring up Doc Severinsen. I wanted to talk to you about some of the great old drummers, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So one of my dad's best friends was Louis Belson. And I had the pleasure of going to dinner one night with Pearl Bailey and Louis Belson. And then Louis was playing in town as well. And I also got to see one of Buddy Rich's last concerts that he did in Chicago before he passed away. When you think back to that golden era of those sort of big band players, besides people like Louis and Buddy Rich, who are your favorites?
Well, it's hard to beat those two guys, both different styles, and, epitomized the period of music, American music, from the late 20s to the end of the 50s, where you really, really had to be a good musician, to be, first of all, employed. Buddy Rich, of course, took it to another level. Louis was a gentleman as well, and Louis was a great all-around musician. Wrote music, was an arranger,
yep.
Did incredible work with Duke Ellington. Played with everybody. He was more of kind of a freelancer, where Buddy was the star of the Tommy Dorsey Band.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back, some of the drummers that I would mention, most people wouldn't necessarily know of them, but the original, this missing link between kind of the swing drummers and the bop drummers was a guy named Kenny Clarke, who lived in England, I believe, moved to England in any case, and big influence on people. Mm-hmm. I was once in a group of drummers at a club in New York watching Buddy Rich and his orchestra, and then meeting and talking to Buddy afterwards with this group of drummers, some of them well-known, these drummers. And he got on the subject of his favorite drummers, and he was saying, "Well, to hear Buddy Rich talk about the great Chick Webb."
Oh, yeah.
Here's Buddy Rich, arguably one of the greatest drummers of the modern era, and he's talking about his favorite drummer, Chick Webb, who, among other things, discovered Ella Fitzgerald, who had the greatest band in Harlem in the 30s when the best band in the world came out of Harlem. Yeah. And they used to have these very famous cutting contests, and nobody could beat the Chick Webb Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And he died very young. He's not well, but if you listen to the both his recordings and what they called air checks, which were kind of like sound checks, just an amazing drummer. But you had Sonny Greer with Duke Ellington, Joe Jones with Count Basie, one of my favorite Count Basie drummers was a guy named Speedy Rufus Jones.
Great.
And he played with him, I guess, in the late 60s. Amazing drummer. Sonny Payne also in the early 60s with Count Basie. It was gymnastic with the drumstick. One of my favorite experiences with drummers of that era was I was very good friends with the late great Joe Morello, the genius behind all the different time signatures Dave Brubeck and his quartet employed. It's all Joe's idea to do everything in crazy time signatures, Take Five, and Lou Rondo a la Turk in 9/8. And so Joe was a teacher of mine in the 80s. And we got very, very close. He lived in New Jersey. And I also knew a guy named Mel Lewis. Mel Lewis and Thad Jones had their great orchestra and played in New York every Monday at the Village Vanguard for decades, literally. And Mel, more than almost any other jazz drummer I've ever met, hated rock and roll. He just hated rock and roll. Uh-huh. But he liked me as a person, you know. Uh-huh. And there was a place in New York called Frank Ippolito's Professional Percussion Center, and it was a place where drummers used to hang out. And I would go there as a kid, and I would watch some of these guys come through town, and they'd play on practice pads on the counter. But the story I'd like to tell you is that I got a call from Charlie Watts one day in 1989 telling me that they were playing at Shea Stadium, the Rolling Stones. And he knew I knew both Joe Morello and Mel Lewis. And he said, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't possibly be interested in seeing our band, but it would mean so much to me if I could meet them.
Right.
So I said to Charlie Watts, I'll arrange it. So I literally picked them up at their homes, Joe Morello, Mel Lewis, and a mutual friend of ours, Dan Gottlieb, also another great young drummer. And we all drove out to Shea Stadium. And seeing Charlie Watts seeing the expression on Charlie Watts' face.
Oh, I bet.
When Joe Morello and Mel Lewis walked in was priceless.
Yeah.
He was like, a kid at FAO Schwartz in New York.
Sure.
And they had a great conversation. And what was interesting was Mel loved the concert.
Oh.
Here he is railing against rock and roll for 50 years. And he really enjoyed it. He died not long after this.
Hmm.
He was very ill at the time when he came out. And he went to see the Rolling Stones, which is something he never thought he would ever do. Hmm. And he loved it.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, it was one of the great privileges of my life to be able to, you know, help create that meeting.
Well, this I feel like there's a connection between the sort of big band experience, which a lot of people, you know, who are like young people today don't know what that is, right? They had no access to it. And I got lucky. My dad, who was a radio TV guy here in Chicago at the studio I'm basically in right now, WGN, for years, like 30 years, and big jazz fan, introduced me to all that. He used to host the big band concerts in the suburbs where they'd bring folks in. But that kind of experience and fullness to me is very reminiscent of going and seeing Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band in terms of it's like it's not just a show. You know, there's something sort of bigger going on, and you feel like you're involved in an experience and even a narrative or a story that's bigger than the one that you walked in the amphitheater thinking about.
Well, I've always known, and Bruce has talked about that, when we play if we play 30 songs, it should add up to an entire experience. It's not just a collection of 30 songs. There's a larger meaning there. And, you know, I reiterate that it's such a privilege to play on songs that are meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine with playing on any song because drums, I'm a drummer for hire. You know, you hire me to play the drums the way I play them and the way you want to hear them for your particular thing. But to have such thoughtful songs and songs that have made such an impact on people, and then you combine that with a stage show that is really not necessarily a quote-unquote show is our lives up there. It's what we know how to do. We grew out of the rhythm and blues soul review type of Jersey Shore band. That's what you had to do. You had to play for 6-7 hours a night, and you got good at faking songs. You got good at patter. You got good at endurance. And, you know, what we basically are is a bar band, you know, and in the best sense of that word, because that's where people went to be entertained. And New Jersey was full of them when I was growing up, and, you know, in the 50s and 60s, there's so many places to play. So what we bring to the stage now really is you know, our interpretation of what we saw as young musicians, whether it was, you know, James Brown, who I saw when I was 13 in Newark, New Jersey in 1964, or Sam and Dave, or some of the Motown acts. You know, they dress sharp, they look sharp, they sang in tune. Whatever else was going on behind the scenes, Showtime was Showtime. And we bring that, you know, that element to what we do for 4 hours on stage. And every night, it's, you know, it's not a question of, you know, one night you're good and the next night, well, you're tired, whatever. We bring it every night, and Bruce brings it every night. And, you know, it's to be back there playing the drums, I'm pretty amazed at how he does it, to tell you the truth.
Sure, sure. One of the things I wanted to ask you, and we're close to wrapping up, but I found this great Ringo Starr quote. And he said, quote, "I never studied anything, really. I didn't study the drums. I joined bands and made all the mistakes on stage." And I love that, you know, and I wonder if you can, we talk a lot about improvisation as being a place where you're sort of embracing failure and risk and learning to sort of navigate between that. And I wonder, especially coming up early, is that something that you sort of had to learn to be comfortable with, or did it kind of live in your bones?
Well, some of the best moments I've ever had on record have been mistakes. And you certainly learn from your mistakes if you're open to making them. You know, you try to be as excellent as you can. Nobody's perfect. And I've always subscribed to, when I was a kid, I heard a quote of JFK's that I think he got from a Greek philosopher, that, you know, one should live their life along lines of excellence. And that's how I've always approached drumming. Of course, you make mistakes and you do stupid things. And, you know, you also learn as a drummer, if you do something that isn't quite right, do it again and people think it's part of the arrangement.
There you go.
So as you get older, you learn these tricks and how to get through doing a show. And, you know, we always laugh about bands who have laminated set lists. We don't have a laminated set list. We have a general format, and then Bruce goes out and changes it every night. And that's the exciting part of it, because while it's not improv per se, it is, because he'll change an arrangement. He'll certainly, out of 30 songs, he'll play 15 ones that you never thought you'd be playing, and you might not have played 15 or 20 years. So you are living on and playing on the edge, and that made it incredibly exciting. And even if we didn't do that, it still would be very exciting, because the music is so, in many ways, very, very uplifting.
Max Weinberg, he'll be bringing his jukebox show to the City Winery in Chicago on August 15th. Max, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure. And listen, I tell you, that jukebox show is fun. We've been playing. We started it, actually, in Evanston. Mark Stein, my best friend and manager, who I know you know.
I do.
You played soccer with him at Nutrier in 1983, right?
Oh, you have all the details.
I know as much about you as you know about me.
Apparently.
He started this jukebox idea where the band plays all requests from the audience.
Yeah.
And it's really fun, and it's geared to having a party. So it's not a concert. No, it's really fit for clubs. We played City Winery in New York two nights in a row, sold out last week. And it's just pandemonium. People call out the songs. I'm playing with a bunch of guys that are really great and are from Jersey Shore, and they know every song. So I hope people come out and see this band. And we'll be in and around the Chicago area doing some stuff. You'll be hearing from me.
Great. Thanks, Max.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to meet you, Kelly.
Okay, I really appreciate it. Take care.
Well, I've been working in a home.